Good morning. So I was a part of a gathering something like this that occurred, I'm guessing, around 15 years ago, that I remember very well. The thing about it is that my role was reversed. Somebody else was up on stage, and I was a person standing in the back of a crowded room. It was a gathering of leaders, lay leaders, pastors, higher-up officials, in the denomination of which my wife and I were a part at the time and of which this church was a part. And we were engaged in a practice that almost all of us in the room felt good about. We had a sense or a belief that God could communicate to one person a message for somebody else. This sometimes takes the form of what's described in the Bible, particularly in the Old Testament, as prophecy. And so we engaged in this practice in our gatherings occasionally. And so on this occasion that I remember, I was the one singled out. It's probably the one time in my life where being tall did me a disservice. You, the tall one, in the back of the room, I think God is giving me something to say to you. Now, this, in the context of the group, was a to-be-desired experience, to be singled out, honored with a communication from God. Only this time it didn't go in the way that I would have liked. The person said to me, "This is what I think God is saying to you, O tall one." I think God is saying, you need to make a choice, one or the other. You need to get off the fence. Now, that sounds kind of vague, but I and those who knew me would have known immediately what that message, were it to have been true, would have implied. I, back then and today, am both a scientist and a pastor. I inhabit these worlds that some see as being in conflict with each other happily, amicably. I don't feel tension between them. Nor do I feel that God does. I don't feel that God is sort of waiting for me to choose one or the other. You know, that he's glowering down, "Would you please get off the fence?" So I knew immediately, no, you're wrong. I didn't have a moment's hesitation about the on-targetness of that communication to me. But I can still remember it. It's one of these rare memories where I can picture the room, I can picture the people, I can bring to mind what I felt. Because all attention turned to me. Again, this was a to-be-desired experience. And as a part of the groupness of the experience, there was not room for me to say out loud, "I don't think so." Right? Or, "Let me ask you some questions about that." Or, "Is this a sense of some people in the room towards me?" This was a group of faith people who, for many, they felt that science was kind of a sketchy endeavor. And particularly my branch, I'm involved in genetics, where I use information about the nature of the relatedness of species derived from evolution. Right? So that's what comes to my mind immediately, is somebody's agenda here, somebody's uncomfortable with this in the room, not God. But because of the general approval of this method of communication, the desirability thereof, the sentiment in the room, I was silent. And I carry that with me. I don't think I was ever really that comfortable with this form of singling people out from up front. But I can tell you that if I am now in a similar setting where somebody with authority from up front singles out people in the room, even if it's for affirmation, I have to either, because of the anxiety that comes up in me, I have to either dissociate, like go somewhere else in my mind, or leave the room. Right? it has stayed with me. So the topic for this morning is religious traumatization. And specifically, since Christianity has been the predominant form of religion in our culture, and we here in this room are a Jesus-centered Christian church, the topic is really Christian traumatization. Right? Not a happy topic, but it's one that keeps coming back to me because I see it again and again and again in the text. I see the perception of God towards us as human beings, of our traumatization in so many different ways, how God perceives that and responds to it, and how specifically Jesus sees and responds to religious traumatization. It's also a topic that keeps coming back to me because I have this experience that's still alive, and I hear your stories of experiences that produce what looks like traumatization that are still alive. Devoted Jesus followers who become anxious, not from reading the Bible, but from talking about the Bible. Devoted Jesus followers for whom certain forms of Christian music makes them anxious and have to run from the room. Devoted Jesus followers who can't enter a group faith experience without getting dizzy or lightheaded or short of breath or sweaty, right? It's a real thing in the world around us. My guess is many of you have little pockets of this kind of experience, but we're a self-selecting group, right? We're here. There's a whole host of people who wouldn't come in this door for a variety of reasons, one of which is Christian traumatization. So we're going to look at this from a story that I keep coming back to. I was looking back. I taught from this story in August. I taught from this story last October. It just is in me. I can't get away from it. Not because it says the same things, but because my appreciation of the perceptiveness and sophistication of Jesus as he interacts with religious trauma keeps going deeper through this story. We'll use that as an opportunity to do like a mini education thing on the nature of trauma, what it looks like, specifically in a religious setting. I don't know if it's something that's relevant to you or to people around you. And then spend a little bit of time talking about where do we go from here? What do we do? Is there something we can do to contend with this thing that's in our world? So to the story. This comes from the account of the life of Jesus as told by his close friend and associate, John. And it goes like this. Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. At daybreak, he appeared again in the temple court, where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The religious experts and ministers brought in a woman who had been caught committing adultery and made her stand in the center of the group. Then they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery." This moment made me think about my experience and what they would have said. "Tom, you have been caught in the very act of committing science." "I'm sorry." "Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Now, in our holy text, Moses commanded that such a woman be stoned to death. What do you say about it?" So this moment has all the hallmarks of a kind of occurrence that is likely to produce crushing lifelong traumatization for this woman. Right? The conversations in religious settings and Christian circles tend to focus around, well, what did she do? You know, what constitutes adultery? Like those sorts of things. But front and center is this woman. Now we'll look a little bit more at what's likely to produce long-lasting detrimental effects from an occurrence of harm. But this woman is experiencing a threat to her life, right? One likely outcome is that she will, at the end of this, all be dead. If she's not put to death, she's experiencing public shaming that is likely to produce for her being excluded, being a pariah. If the shame persists, if that's what's left at the end of this occurrence, nobody in town, you know, these folks gathered in the temple courtyard who are likely her peers, her friends, people of a kind with her, maybe her family members, none of them will want to associate with her or be near her because she's been publicly shamed and because she will remind them that this could happen to me too. Right? So the threat of death, public shame, the likelihood of exclusion or expulsion, and she too is powerless. She has no voice. She is silenced. She's unable to speak back. The ones in charge of the whole society are the ones marching her in. They have the validation of the text, the God text behind it all. And so she is silent, quiet, powerless. All of these things contribute to the likelihood that this will produce long-lasting detrimental effects in her. And we'll describe those in a moment. But there is one dissenter in the group. The story goes on. They said this to trap him, Jesus, so that they might have ground for bringing charges against him. But Jesus bent down and began writing in the dust with his finger. It's like one of the best occurrences ever. When they began questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "The one of you who is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." Then he bent down and wrote in the dust again. On hearing this, they began to leave. One by one, the older ones first, until he was left alone with the woman still there. Standing up, Jesus said to her, "Where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, sir." Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Now go, and from the now, no more sin." So some observations. The foundational interaction of Jesus with the accusing men, the traumatizers, is complete and utter disengagement. Or whatever comes next, whatever is actually said, the first message of Jesus to those watching is, "I don't do that." Right? Who cares what he's scribbling in the dust? That's irrelevant. The whole thing, Jesus doesn't talk. He doesn't respond. He doesn't ask questions to the men or to the woman about what she's done. He doesn't go back to the text with them and say, "Let's look, is this really what Moses meant?" He doesn't try to cut a plea deal. All of which would be engaging with their system as they are presenting it to Jesus. What Jesus is saying is, whatever you all are doing, however you do this thing of accusation and condemnation and threat and power and dominance and disparities, it has nothing whatsoever to do with me. My kingdom is completely non-overlapping with whatever you are doing. Right? There is no commerce. There's no interaction. There's no overlap. There's no similarity. It's a profound and utter disengagement, difference, non-overlappingness. Which, of course, leaves everybody baffled. Right, because the system they are bringing is the one everybody thinks is the way it all works. So they're kind of left swimming. Like, whoa, if we don't do that, what do we do? And of course, it provokes them, the accusers of Jesus. They're not like scratching their heads and going away. They ask more questions. They persist. So Jesus stands up and says his one thing to them: "Let the one of you that is without sin cast the first stone at her." Now this too continues the disengagement, right? Because Jesus is just making that up. He's not getting it from the text. It's not something that Moses said. Well, when you find yourself in this kind of circumstance, the ones who are doing the accusing and casting the stones, they have to actually be clean themselves. Right? Jesus is just saying, in my system, in contrast to yours, you can't do that. Unless you yourselves are clean, you know, which is a pretty small group. And so what happens then is just remarkable. I've always thought that the primary, you know, bummer for these group of traumatizing, accusing men is that they didn't get Jesus this time. Right? They walk away and they huddle on the outskirts of the temple court. Well, that was a fail. What are we going to try tomorrow? You know. But the disempowering and the sending away of these men, it's just astounding. So the first thing that's destroyed is the power of their unanimity. They come together in their rage, unified by their desire to kill this woman and through that to discredit Jesus. And their hope is to bring all the people together into that through this collective form of execution known as stoning. But instead, what happens is, first of all, their loud, angry voices are silenced. Right? I mean, what could happen in this situation is that the violence escalates. It's tit for tat, back and forth, rising and rising until a fight breaks out. But these men who've come in with this silent woman, their voices of accusation, they don't say a word. And they leave not together, but one by one by one by one. Their unanimity dissolved. And I try to imagine, too, what it would have been like henceforth for the interactions between these people gathered in the courtyard and the accusers who've gone away. Right? I mean, these people and the woman watch each individual accuser come to the realization, well, I guess I can't cast a stone. Because I am like her. I am not different in a way that gives me standing to produce accusation and condemnation. Right? That's what they're saying without words as they walk away. And so everybody in the town knows that. So the next time one of them tries to bring accusation, produce condemnation, the next time they come as a group, the people in town are going to say, no, you can't do that anymore. You don't have that standing, that authority, that power. You're not meaningfully different than us in a way that can produce this kind of interaction. That possibility is poof, gone, evaporated. And I just think about what that would have been like for that woman. I mean, imagine if you've experienced trauma at the hands of somebody in authority or some group, and Jesus were with you, and he turned that on its head, so that those people, you watch them walk away one by one by one by one, disempowered, not able to come back and do the same thing again. I don't know. That would seem pretty amazing. And then there's this moment. So the text says, they all go away, leaving Jesus alone. So it seems to be implying that Jesus has done his best to draw the group rage towards himself, with her. And they have this little conversation. And it seems intimate and sweet and quiet. And I've always kind of wondered, well, how do we know about it? Did Jesus tell people, you know? But I forgot. This whole thing started out in the morning with a crowd of people at sunrise gathered in the temple courtyard to have awesome, exciting conversations about God's stuff. Right, they're there not bothering anybody, maybe getting in a couple of hours of interesting conversation before they head off to work. When it says Jesus is left alone, I think it's just the relief that the men are gone. The whole crowd is still there with Jesus and this woman in the midst. And she now, instead of being labeled and branded with shame, a pariah, someone to avoid as you encounter her in the public square, has been restored, dignified, made into a heroine. I would even say exalted in the midst of these people. Because they've all got something to hide, right? They've got something that they could be accused of that could make them of a kind with her. But she's been saved. I wonder for her if she would be someone to whom they would want to be connected henceforth. Someone at the center of gathering. Having been singled out by Jesus, truthfully, by the accusers, for what turns out to be an experience of restoration and dignity and freeing. The last thing I'll say about this story, there still is this last line at the end, right? Jesus, you just wish they'd left this out. Now go, and from the now, no more sin. I'm just going to say straight out, I don't think that Jesus, with this last phrase, is undoing all the system dismantling that he has done up to this moment. Right? I don't think he's saying to the woman, yeah, now that they're gone, the truth is, you shouldn't do that. It's a problem. If you do it again, I might not be here to get you off. Right? I deeply believe that this is a statement of freedom and liberation to this woman. There's a parallel story, one of these bizarro world parallel, clearly intentional tellings of a story that occurs in John chapter 5, so three chapters prior. There's a man who's been paralyzed for 38 years. He spends time beside this magical pool in Jerusalem that when its surface is tickled by the wings of angels, the first person into the pool gets healed. The problem is, of course, because of his immobility, he hasn't been able to take advantage of this thing. Jesus comes along, sees him, recognizes, boy, he's been here for a long time, has a brief conversation, heals him. He jumps up. The problem is it's happened on the Sabbath when you're not supposed to do these kind of things. So the man, the first act, the first thing he does with his new mobility is runs and tells on Jesus to the religious experts. Oh, Jesus did this to me. Jesus finds him and says to this man, don't sin anymore. He uses exactly the same phrase that he uses to this woman. Don't sin anymore. Now, it's a bit puzzling, right? You think, well, that was a bad thing to do, but how is that sin? He actually was conforming to the expectations of the law when he went and told on Jesus. He was just informing. But my sense is that Jesus is saying to him, you have been colluding with a corrupt system, playing a role in that system. I have freed you from that. Don't do it anymore. You don't have to do that anymore. And so he comes to this woman saying, you have been inhabiting a role given to you by the system. You don't have to do that anymore. I just, if you will have taken note, blew up the system. Because we do have a tendency to revert to the way we have been. And I think Jesus is saying you're free from that. That role no longer exists. Don't do it anymore. Whatever the outcome, we don't follow this woman's story as things go forward. I just want to say a few things about the nature of traumatization. So you can put up the first slide. By traumatization, I mean the production of long-lasting detrimental effects. We'll describe a little bit of what those are. By some either experienced or threatened active harm. So specifically harm or threat of harm to the integrity of the self, or to loved ones, or to peers, right? So a thing that produces ongoing detrimental effects in your life or mine doesn't have to happen directly to us. It can happen to somebody we know or love or to people like us, right? We can be traumatized from a distance. A second thing that makes an act likely to produce long-lasting detrimental effects is what I've described as a decreased sense of power or agency or voice, where your ability to resist, to contend with, whatever is going on is diminished. Show the next slide. So the typical kinds of experiences that can become traumatizing are the threat of physical or sexual harm. So the physical harm, the threat of loss of life, is kind of the most dramatic or front and center. We certainly see it in the story of this woman. The real experience or threat of sexual harm. Or other things too, like experienced or threatened shaming, public humiliation, experienced or threatened exclusion or expulsion. So if you're standing in a group of people that has become important to you, to your sense of self, either occurs, you're excluded or expelled, or that's threatened. Social destabilization. So some social group, a family, a church community, fractures, and you're caught in the middle of it. It's become important to you, to your sense of who you are. If that is broken or fractures, if you lose that stability, that can produce traumatization. And again, this can be real or threatened. It can occur to yourself or to loved ones or to peers. And this is the thing, it's a powerful phenomenon, right? So in this story, for example, the traumatization that's inflicted on this woman would have communicated to everybody watching, this could happen to me. It's one act of harm that can control an entire community. So you can show the next slide. There's a whole host, however, of traumatizing experiences, particularly in the context of religion, faith, church, spirituality, that I think can fly under the radar. Right? We have a huge number of ways of denying the reality of traumatization, right? Because it ought not happen in this spiritual context. We have all these tools that we present as communicating God's intentions, God's purposes, that are used to suppress awareness of traumatization. So it can be really hard to perceive, right? For example, we have come to perceive the presence of sexual traumatization as a phenomenon in church. But that has only occurred with a lot of effort, at great cost, over an extended period of time. And we still resist the truthfulness of that. So all of these other things that can produce long-lasting detrimental effects are hard to name. They come out slowly. So, for example, moral trauma. Most of us have some sense of how we think we ought to behave towards other people, a form of goodness, kindness, love, what that looks like. If you, in a setting, are forced or coerced into acting towards other people in a way that violates your own internal moral code, that can produce traumatization. So if you are coerced or convinced to behave towards other people in a way that you feel is not consistent with your notion of kindness, goodness, love, you are violating your own personal integrity. Intellectually, if you are coerced into coming to believe something that you really think is false, that you actually think is not true, right? It's important to most of us to have a sense of truthfulness, what's true, and to adhere to that. If you are forced to believe something that is not true, it can produce long-lasting detrimental effects that reflect traumatization. The same with emotional things. If you are not supposed to feel something that you do. If you have feelings like anger or lust that are impermissible in your context, and so you have to suppress them, that can produce traumatization. Or if you're supposed to feel things that you don't, and so you fake it, right? You're violating your own sense of yourself. If you have been promised certain outcomes for which you commit to behaving in a certain way, thinking, feeling, doing things for the sake of a promised outcome, and that thing doesn't happen. And then especially if you're told that you're just interpreting the outcome wrong, that can produce traumatization. Anything in here that smacks of coercion, manipulation, with important life decisions particularly, so decisions about what you're going to do with your life, who you're going to be connected to, romantically, how you're going to spend your money, right? Now, all of these things are topics worthy of conversation. And all of these things are topics that our faith is interested in. Jesus talks a lot about money, right? It's not that topics are off limits. I think money is one of the most complicated because it is one of the things that most quickly becomes a part of our identity. How much we're earning, how much we have, what we're going to do with it. So almost any conversation from any of us about money becomes potentially traumatizing because it threatens our sense of identity. Right? It's not that the conversations are off limits. It's that it's if they are coercive. If you have no agency, no voice, no ability to question or to engage. You can show the last slide. So, and this is what we do in religious settings. We do all sorts of things to diminish voice. We say, this is what the Bible says. This is what God says. Which usually are just ways of saying, this is what the expert says. Right? Because they're the ones who speak through the Bible or on behalf of God. We use threats of shaming, exclusion, expulsion. All of which really just reflects an anxious system that wants to suppress me and that wants to suppress you. So you can take down the slides. So this leaves us with a question, or at least me, what do we do? Right? I find myself sometimes in a bit of a quandary, because like I'm here, I'm a pastor of a Christian church. I deeply love Jesus. I read the Bible all the time. And you can tell I can't get past one story. Right? It keeps being life-giving to me. I have deeper and deeper perceptions about the awesomeness of Jesus. And his perception and sophistication in dealing with the threat of a traumatizing experience in this story is incredible. I love the community. I love gathering with you on a Sunday morning, having people to my home, talking about spiritual things. I love our music. I love the songs we sing, the experience of worshiping together. And yet I'm aware, too, that for many of us, these things, these forms are traumatizing. Right? Produce anxiety. You see, the thing about trauma is that it produces in you and I this phenomenon. So we avoid the things that traumatize us, right? Because they've harmed us in the past. And so we don't want to experience these unwanted emotions, anger, anxiety. But we also shut down anything that reminds us of them. One of the hallmarks of traumatizing experiences is avoidance. You come to identify things in your world that remind you of what produced harm, and you avoid those things. The problem is it's a pretty nonspecific mechanism. Even though it's meant to be protective, the space given to what we avoid becomes bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And many of the things that we come to avoid are not harmful in and of themselves. They just remind us in a bad way of what hurt us previously. And so I find that in the Christian tradition, for example, so many of the things that God meant for our benefit, we hold at arm's length because they remind us of what threatened us, of what produced harm. So my desire going forward is this. I would like to keep this conversation going. I don't know for how many of you this is relevant or for how many people you know. It seems to me that it's relevant for a lot of us, that many of us are affected by what seems like classic hallmarks of traumatization, again, triggered emotions that are out of proportion to whatever is going on, and avoidance and avoidance and avoidance and avoidance. My desire would be to keep this conversation going. Because if church is producing trauma, if Christianity is producing it, this is where we ought to be having the conversation to emerge from it. So these are my thoughts. That we keep the conversation going in some form or other. I don't know what that would look like. I've put in your bulletin this morning. We're just going to take a couple of minutes. I've put in your bulletin this morning a simple questionnaire. Is this relevant to you, and would you like to participate in a conversation about this topic going forward? Some sort of interaction, some sort of experience, the hallmarks of which would be producing freedom, relief, peace, emergence from the ways that traumatization constrains us. And maybe with the possibility for us and for the people around us to re-engage in a non-anxious, identity-preserving, safe way with some of the means that God has provided for us to connect. So what I want you to do is just take a minute or two. I've put in the handouts, you're being handed out a questionnaire that I used about a year ago just for people as a form of self-examination, to assess whether traumatization is something, this form of traumatization is something that's relevant to you. And then there's also just a little slip of paper for you to check a box. If you'd be interested in having some sort of interaction, those of us for whom this is relevant, some sort of interaction going forward, either just a conversation where we in a safe place can say what we've experienced, maybe find some way to healing, relief, freedom, peace. Just check that box. You can put it in the welcome table on your way out. You can leave your name if you want. If you have specific ideas of what that might look like, you can write it in the space provided there. So I'll just give you a couple of minutes to look at that. And then I'll lead us into communion and the rest of the service. So take 1 minute, 30 seconds. All right, you can keep working on that form, but if you want. Otherwise, stand and pray with me as I lead us into the rest of the service. So Jesus, I think you're attuned to how we behave towards each other as human beings. And it's clear you're aware that the spiritual community is not in some way protected from uses of power that produce these kind of long-lasting detrimental effects. I pray that this would be a safe space, that we would refrain from those ways of relating. And I pray for those of us affected that you would lead us forward into peace, relief, freedom, healing, and that we'd be a place where that kind of activity can spread out into the world. That God, the ways that you mean for us to connect with you that are meant for our benefit can be taken out of the domain of traumatization, anxiety-provokingness, and back into being life-giving. Amen.